guy get, who does psychopharmacology, get interested in teen pregnancy, the group back there kind of dragged me into this. I'm an interventionist, and so I like studying making things work and helping people do better. And the group from the Center for American Indian Health has really been about meeting the needs of American Indians. And so we've been collaborating since the mid-1990s on a variety of different projects. And I'm representing all of them in speaking today. And there's a good group of folks here, including Noblyn Goklish, who's one of the authors of this presentation. And I hope she and Allison will help me answer questions as they come up in the question and answer period. So we're essentially going to kind of walk through the development of this project, talk about our preliminary studies, focus on the findings, and then have a summary and discussion. This is the research project that we did based on SAMHSA funding, and I think the more interesting part of the story is really the tribe and tribal populations and our relationship with the tribe, and happy to talk about that in the question and answer period. So our collaborators, I'm going to talk about them, describe the need, what we know works in terms of what we're trying to accomplish, and then what's not known. So our collaborators are the Navajo Nation and the White Mountain Apache Tribe. And we, those two tribes, work together with the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health. If you think about the Navajo and Apache tribes in Arizona, they comprise about 20% of all reservation-based Native Americans in the United States. They had first contact with settlers a long, long time ago, and a very complex history, as you can imagine. Lots of hard-fought battles, and even though there are significant problems within Indian country, there is an enormous, I think, pride and desire for self-determination that has come out of those battles. The Navajo Nation is the largest reservation in the United States, about 25,000 square miles. It covers the northern area of Arizona and New Mexico and some of Utah. It's about 125,000 of the tribal members who live on the reservation. And it has one of the largest reservation branch governments, has a president, vice president, legislative branch and judicial branch, and it also has local health boards and chapters and its own IRB. So this project actually had to go through 12 levels of review at the community level before it was finally accepted, and that was after it worked with communities in developing the proposal and the interventions. White Mountain Apache is 25,000 square mile reservation in east central Arizona. About 15,500 now tribal members. It's got a tribal council with a chairman and vice chairman. And again, a number of entities are involved in reviewing and approving this proposal. Here are the reservation sites. In black, Tuba City, Fort Defiance, and Gallup are the three sites on the Navajo Reservation, and White River, down in the bottom, is the central city of the White Mountain Apache Reservation. So there are a number of opportunities as well as challenges. These are, in some respects, some of the most beautiful country in all of the United States, and significant resources also. But it doesn't take much to driving through the community to notice the poverty, and the statistics speak loud and clear about low educational achievement, high unemployment rates. And many of you may be familiar with the area around White Mountain Apache for the forest fires that occurred a couple of years ago up in the Sholo area. The center was founded in 1991 based on about 27 years of collaboration with tribes in the Southwest, and our mission is to work with those tribes to raise the health status and self-sufficiency of American Indian people to the highest level possible. We have 11 sites around the country with 130 employees, and over half of those are native. It's an enormous infrastructure that provides a lot of support for the program that I'll describe. So a variety of risks for Native American teen moms. I've heard a little bit about this already. If you just think about the risk factors for teens in general for their kind of long-term outcome, there are a variety of issues that teen motherhood is associated with. If you add those to teen parenthood, you get a complicated mix, if you will. And the teen moms that we're working with are really at the intersection of those risks. And so if you look at it, it's lots and lots of issues there. And these are young ladies who really are in need of a significant support and intervention. It was interesting to kind of look at the statistics in the Houston area. I guess the way we've thought about it is in terms of the percentage of teen moms on the reservation communities who begin childbearing during adolescence. And in the United States, it's about 25%, and on the reservation communities, it's about 46%. And we're also aware that about two-thirds of teen moms have a second child before their 18th birthday. So early childbirth and then significant amount of childbirth during during the teenage years. Native American communities have very large populations of young people under 18 years of age. White Mountain Apache Reservation, for example, over half the population is under 24. So these are, in some respects, youth and young people-driven communities. And there are significant, again, health disparities. All the things that you see in young people that are significant that affect both their mental and physical health. I think we're painfully aware of the under-resourced mental and behavioral health programs on the reservations and a real shortage of trained Native American healthcare providers. Even though there are healthcare resources in the community, most of the healthcare resources are provided by non-Native folks. There are also huge transportation issues. If you look at the size of those reservations, even though people may only live 2 or 3 miles away, without transportation services, it's very difficult to get to health centers. And if you look at IHS budgets and other people's budgets, it's very hard to start thinking about prevention when they're really in the kind of crisis intervention, crisis medical care mode. On the other hand, all you have to do is spend any time on the reservation and you really appreciate the important role of family as a organizing structure, family and clan. And it's a very strong history in terms of healing traditions, puberty ceremonies, and other ceremonies that really bind people together and are part of their cultural identity. And there's also a very strong tradition about extended families being involved in childcare. So if you take the real powerful protective factors of kind of family involvement, it makes it a lot easier to think about what kinds of interventions are going to be useful and accepted. So we really became very interested in home visiting programs, in part because of a variety of different issues. But we like the idea that you can, by working with pregnant teens, you can begin to decrease risk factors for them and their health. But also, if you work well with those moms and get them started off right, that you'll have an impact on the next generation. And if you're doing something enduring with their first child, then that should have carry over to the second, third, and fourth child. And hopefully, if you really do something effective with the moms, that you'll actually begin to encourage increased birth spacing between the first, second, and third child so that these moms have a chance to not only care for their infants, but to have time for their own subsequent growth and development. So as I mentioned, family is highly valued in Native American cultures. These approaches are no-brainers. In some communities, it seems like this is not the way to go. School-based programs may be more important, but here, family-based programs really have a salience that is very powerful. Home visiting also overcomes the transportation barriers, as well as some of the language and cultural barriers that we see with young ladies using the Indian Health Service or other health clinics. Like I said, we go to where people live, and this is a photo of a home and some laundry being done, taking care of business. So in our literature review, we really see effective parenting as the most powerful way to reduce adolescent problem behaviors. So in some respects, even though we're working with teen moms, we have a long-term goal of improving the next generation, the lives of the next generation of children, and in some respects, rebuilding communities from the pregnant mom on up. These prevention programs often have reasonably large effect sizes rather than child-focused prevention programs. And we also believe that by improving parenting, you hit a number of problem areas for children, such as childhood injury. So even though you're working on parenting behavior and raising kids to be healthy and nutrition and that sort of stuff, you're probably also going to have impacts on other health risks for the young people. We also view working with pregnant moms as a kind of a touch point, if you will. Our experience has been that even though most of the moms in our program have used substances in periods of time prior to their pregnancy, that once they find out they're pregnant, they actually are at a nice point where they can be talked to about not using substances. And many of the young ladies in our program have stopped using alcohol or drugs during pregnancy, in part because they know about the risk to their child. So taking that as an opportunity to make life changes, another important component of the program. These family home visiting kinds of programs have been demonstrated to be effective. I think probably the most famous set of home visiting programs are the ones done by David Olds, who has worked in a variety of urban and rural communities and demonstrated the efficacy of nurse home visiting programs. So what we didn't know when we started this was whether we could do these same kind of home visiting programs in Native American communities. And the other issue, because of the lack of Native American professionals, we wanted to demonstrate or at least find out whether Native American paraprofessionals could be trained to a high standard and then enter the homes of these young ladies and deliver a curriculum with fidelity. Oh my goodness. So this is where we've been. We started off, this is a project that Allison was instrumental and Noveline was involved in also. It was a birth feeding, a breastfeeding project funded by SOS. SOS is Share Our Strength. They're the group who at the end of the year, the American Express Hunger, you know, when you buy something, that's Share Our Strength. And they actually worked with many more moms, I think, than the 160 moms noted there, and were able to achieve breastfeeding rates. Upwards of 70 to 80% at the end of the training. This was an open intervention and really established, I think, our interest in these kinds of early pregnant teen projects. The first funded project where we began to look at fathers was really one that called the Fathers Project. This got some support from the Ford Foundation and C.S. Mott. Our staff actually said, you know, we got to do something for these dads too. And I think we found that working with fathers during this very early period was difficult. The men who were most successful in living were working and really weren't available. And the men who weren't very successful were available but weren't interested. So, and we also found that teaching the same curriculum to moms just didn't seem to have the same emotional salience for dads. They needed something else to kind of grab their attention during this time period. Family strengthening, this was one of the first SAMHSA projects. We actually did a randomized controlled evaluation of this, and this was published in the archives of pediatric and adolescent medicine and documented that we were able to increase mom's knowledge scores, and there were some other trends in that data set suggesting other outcomes too, but the sample size was small. The project that we're going to talk about today is really the Family Spirit Project. Again, we worked with moms and dads. It was a randomized controlled trial and included 167 moms, and that's what we'll be reporting on here today. And then the final project, which was currently underway, we're trying to recruit 320 moms for this project, and I think we're at 230 or 240, something like that, at this point, who have been randomized. And it is really the largest of our three studies and has benefit from all the pilot work that has gone forward in terms of both developing the curriculum as well as developing the evaluation strategy. So, for the study that we were talking about today, the one that was at the bottom, we had 167 teen moms who came in at approximately 28 weeks gestation. Although it was very interesting how imprecise that estimate is, and we probably have moms who were 30, 32 weeks who came into the trial. And they were randomized to the intervention group and to the control group, which was really breastfeeding intervention. So both of these were in-home interventions. So in some respects, to demonstrate efficacy for the Family Spirit intervention above a fairly potent intervention, which was in-home breastfeeding, was quite a challenge. So the goals were to increase parent knowledge and skills, improve mom's health and behavior outcomes, as well as that of the child. And we were following the kids out till 2 years, and we'll be talking about the 12-month data currently. And then we really want to do a skills bank-based or a strengths-based kind of approach, where we work with those strengths of the mom and try and build them and increase their competence in parenting. So this is our conceptual model, and I don't think there's a pointer here. But if you look at the left half, it really is parental factors, and on the right half, it's child factors. And the thing that links them is really the interaction, or what we term in the broadest sense, parenting. So we've decided that there are a variety of programs, prevention programs that'll work on children. There'll be programs that focus on demographic factors or stressors, or look at kind of community issues over the long term. And some will really focus on parental substance abuse or depression, things like that, to try and improve outcomes for children. But we decided to really focus on the interaction between the parent and child as the target of our intervention. The reason we focus on parenting is because there's decent data to suggest that poor parental monitoring and discipline, or parenting strategies, lead to behavioral difficulties of all sorts. And as kids move from early childhood into middle childhood and then into adolescence, some of the problems that we see with substance abuse and delinquent behavior are really the direct result of parenting problems that can begin quite early. So this is just another way of saying this. We're focusing on home visiting that focuses on the parent, stressors within the home, and parenting factors. And the other thing that's an important component is that when we think about what we're doing is in terms of community-based participatory research, everyone is learning, and we believe that there is, as part of this program, a wonderful side effect that the folks who work in the program and deliver services to these young ladies actually become leaders within their communities and will speak powerfully to the needs for young families in a way that only they can do. So this is the participant profile between the treatment and control group and the total. Again, we have some older moms in the 18, 19-year-old range, and again, there were some moms who we thought were 19 when they were pregnant and actually were probably closer to 20 and a smidge more. Again, there were some moms who were 29 plus weeks, even though we were shooting for 28. And most of these were first-time moms. Currently married, very few, but many of them had male partners, and the average age of the male partner was more close to the age of the young lady than what we tend to see in East Baltimore, where the men are much, much older than the teens who they get pregnant. This is the four sites and kind of how they contributed. And again, if you look at employment, we did standard kind of ratings of this, and most of these young people were in school or taking a break from school. And as noted by the previous speaker, a lot of these folks lived in the home with their parents, or they lived in the home with their partner. So what we were able to demonstrate, as we've demonstrated repeatedly, is that the paraprofessionals that we train can go into the home and work with these young moms, recruit them, engage them, and randomize them, and then really improve their knowledge over the period of time of the intervention. I think knowledge is pretty important. My public health colleagues say, knowledge. So what we're really looking for is real behavior change or harder outcomes. And one of the problems with these kinds of home visiting interventions is you have to find a proximal outcome in order to get a grant. So what are you going to do at 1 year period of time that proves that this is a Zowie intervention? Well, we use knowledge as one. In our current trial, we're using the home observation of environment, the home score, as a proximal outcome. But we think this next finding is probably one of the most interesting findings, and that is that on the ITSE, which is a similar to the Child Behavior Checklist, which is a self-report scale done by moms about their infants, that in our treatment group, these moms had less externalizing, or these babies had less externalizing symptoms, which consisted of activity and impulsivity, aggression and defiance, and a thing here they call peer aggression, which only has a couple of items in it, given their infants. But this is a scale that can be used in 12-month-olds and has documented really across the board, except for the aggression and defiance area, a positive outcome. And if you look at the clinical effect sizes, they're about 0.6, which are pretty decent effect sizes for preventative interventions. That's almost the size of what I would look for antidepressants or other kinds of pharmacotherapy interventions. The other piece was that we also saw an outcome in terms of less separation distress, so that these were youngsters who, in general, were better in terms of fewer externalizing conditions, but also were more comfortable and were doing better in terms of even internalizing type symptoms. So we're preparing this manuscript for publication at this time. Enjoy presenting the results to you, and I think are excited about the idea that you can do something from pregnancy through 6 months and actually begin to see infant outcomes that are non-cognitive but are in the behavioral domain that are showing up as early as 1 year. So with that, I'd like to quit and take questions or comments. Yes. Maybe folks from the community might want to talk about that. Our experience was, and this was one of our early trials where we began to do randomization, was that, and the way we talked with the community about it was that you, with limited resources, you want to know what works. And with a small number of participants in these studies, you can change practices over extended period of time for many, many moms and know that what you're investing in, your limited dollars, you're investing in things that actually will work. So, plus, the control groups are all potent. So we don't use control groups that don't have anything in them, and they are currently above the standard of care. So our most recent study, we actually are using what we call optimized standard care, which is transportation services. So we're testing this intervention against transportation services to prenatal and well-baby care. And the community so far seems to be reasonably comfortable with the idea that people are getting randomized. Individual participants struggle with making the decision about whether they want to participate. So, you know, with all randomized controlled trials, you always get a sampling bias of people who are willing to be randomized and who can be consented and participate. And so we probably lose some of the most disadvantaged moms. But again, if you look at the age of our moms and the characteristics of the larger demographics, we feel like we're getting a fairly representative sample of teen pregnancy on reservations. Yes? Hey, Jane. that we had to measure was school participation. When you hear, when Noveline and others tell me about what school is like for these young ladies, about what attendance is like, comings and goings to school, it's a very difficult thing to quantify. And I think we did it kind of straight up, what grade are you in? And that probably doesn't capture very well kind of school attendance, especially around pregnancy. Yes. I don't think so. The moms who came into this were pregnant at the time, and so we engaged them about pregnancy, labor, and delivery, and as part of that, we prepared them to breastfeed afterwards. That's the breastfeeding intervention. So our breastfeeding rates in this study were in that 60, 70, 80% range, too. I don't remember the exact number. People have talked with us about attachment, and attachment is a key concept in early childhood development. And if you think about it, breastfeeding is can be a proxy for time spent with baby and interaction, but really isn't focused on knowledge and skills. And what we demonstrated through the knowledge and skills component of this is increased knowledge and skills, and then knowledge and skills having moms in the treatment group who had increased knowledge actually demonstrated infants who had kind of better behavior, if you will, at year one is kind of where we're going with this. That breastfeeding is a wonderful thing, and we think every mom should do it, but it may not be sufficient with at-risk moms to put them in the very best place possible. Right, so they got support, they got in-home support, and they got breastfeeding education. And